So the organisers have given me 3 hours to do that, so I'd better get going. There's no doubt, I'm sure you'll agree with me, that we are heading down a tunnel, we're heading down a pathway that is a highly digital, immersed life. Digital technologies, we're weaving those into the very fabric of our everyday lives more and more. You would agree? And also in the library too, I'm sure. But let me just show you these two slides. This is the courtyard where the Pope, where someone comes out and announces the new Pope. This was back in 2005. I can't remember the Pope's name. Perhaps I should, if I'm here. Whoops. Okay, so that was back 2 popes ago, 2005. This is the same place when the most recent Pope was announced. I mean, the world is changing, is it not? In terms of our connectivity and our embracing of digital technologies that we are not just adding to our lives, we are weaving into the very fabric of our lives, and I'm going to explore that more. And of course, it's having an effect on education, yes? And on libraries. Let me just read you this quote from The Shallows. The predominant sound in the modern library is the tapping of keys, not the turning of pages. How does that make you feel? You're 30 seconds with the table that you're at. 30 seconds only. What are some of your feelings around that? Some of your thoughts around that? I'm going to grab your attention again, because I know that I could let that discussion could go all 4 days. I'm sure. It really open a hornet's nest in a conference like this. So let's just pause that for the moment. It just reminds me of a joke, though. In my family, we don't have blonde jokes or Irish jokes. We call them wallies. Right? So a wally walks into a library and goes up to the person, the librarian at the counter, and said, "Could I please have a hamburger and a large Coke and fries?" And the librarian looks kind of bewildered and says, "Sorry, but this is actually a library." And the wally goes, "Oh, sorry, could I please have..." Now, you would be familiar with the notion of a digital native. Those people have been born into a world where digital technologies are everywhere. And therefore, you think of digital immigrants. I had a couple of digital immigrants with me this morning trying to help me with all of this. those who find themselves in a new world.
Yeah.
And even the language is different, yeah? And we talk about our teenagers as being digital immigrants now. And we can also think of our tweens now. I was speaking to a kindergarten teacher, that's the first year of school in New South Wales. Every state and territory, that's fantastic. Well done. And she said that she only had 6 kids in the class who didn't have a smartphone.
Kindergarten.
Only 6 who didn't. Not just phones, but smartphones. But where is it going to stop? Ah, yes. What I'd like to talk about today is not just that we have added technologies to our lives, but that we have actually embraced them in a way that they are having a fairly strong shaping effect on the way we think about the world, the way we understand others, the way we understand relationships. It's changing our world. And that's what I'd like to explore a little bit with you. Now, some reading that you will do, some sort of dialogue in this space, it has a very strong sense of utopia around where we're heading. A lot of professional readings, probably in the librarian space as well as educational space, will talk really quite optimistically about where we're heading with all of this, yeah? But there's also a lot of stuff you can read, and I'm going to refer to a number of books today that would fit into this space. More of the dystopian sort of notions. Oh no, woe is us. Now, there's a book, I think it's a really helpful book, called It's Complicated. Great title.
by Dana Boyd. And well, basically she says, well, really we're living somewhere in the middle here. And when it comes to teenagers and how they embrace with technology, well, it's complicated. But I'm going to suggest to you that this complication that she speaks of, I actually think we can bring some clarity to it. Not only can we bring some clarity to it, I think we can actually bring some wisdom and discernment to our students in this space so that they can navigate through this without it being overwhelmingly complicated. I'm going to talk about four different areas today. I'm going to talk about informationism. A little bit of an overview of these four areas. Informationism, narcissism, mediationism. Yes, we've got some ringing here for narcissism. Mediationism, I'm giving the talk, I can make up the words. And digital epistemology. We're going to just quickly have a look at that idea of how our understanding of how we know what is true, what we use as authority for truth, is changing because of these technologies as well. First of all, informationism. Anyone tell me what this is? Yeah. Do you know how many people, when I ask that question, do this? Yes, it's the Morse codey thingy. That's right. It's called the Morse key. It was the either end of the telegraph, and it was used to transmit the Morse code. Now, what is interesting is that before the telegraph was invented, the fastest way you could communicate information from one side of a country to another was the fastest way that it could be transmitted by a person. Maybe on horseback or maybe on a steam train. But as soon as we had the telegraph, we had this network of wires going around America. And, well, we could actually not only send information almost instantly across from one country to another, we could actually send it to multiple places all at once. That changed everything. And it changed everything in the same way. Do you remember this adage? Speaking of phrases this morning. To a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Yeah? When you have a certain technology at your disposal, that actually shapes how you see the world. It's quite a profound phrase. So, to a man with a telegraph, all information is seen as good. See, suddenly, so news reports of crimes that happened overnight in Los Angeles could now be transmitted the next morning to Detroit and New York. And that wasn't available to them before, so they never got that information. But now they could. And so it was the start of seeing that the transmission of information being something that's a must, that's a good. And that information, well, we started to idolise it at this point, dare I suggest. Now, information isn't bad. It's good to be informed, is it not? But what we're talking about here is perhaps a worldview that starts to idolise information, such that we get to a point where you can have news on the television, and it's not enough to have a newsreader talking to you. We've also got scrolling bars now giving us all this other information. And maybe some data up in the top right-hand corner as well. You know, you're hearing about something that's happened here in Australian politics. Down the bottom, you've got a bus crash in Rio kills 12 people. What do you do with that? Neil Postman, in his book Technopoly, said this: the telegraph may have made the country into one neighbourhood, but it's a peculiar one, populated by strangers who knew nothing but the most superficial facts about each other. And if I was to paraphrase that now, the internet may have made the world into one neighbourhood, but it's a peculiar one, populated by strangers who know nothing but the most superficial facts about each other. Is that true?
Yes.
And Quinton Schultz, and this is where I get this notion of information, this word, informationism, I like it. it's like saying that we're starting to idolise information. He says, we are succumbing to informationism, a non-discerning, vacuous faith in the collection and dissemination of information as a route to social progress and personal happiness. I just need to be informed, and that will give me a sense of security and safety and personal satisfaction in life. I'm going to wind, I'm just jumping forward a little bit, but think about our social connections through our social media and so forth. I just need to know what's going on. And he goes on to say, and this is great, as the pool of information grows, our actual knowing declines. Yeah. Reading online about the needs of the world, for instance, is never the same as personally knowing people in need. There's a mediation effect going on here. Technology is mediating between us and real aspects of God's world. We'll come more to that in a minute. Blogging, I found this poster. Never before have so many people with so little to say said so much to so few. There you go, you put that one up in your library. See, what we're seeing is that context is declining. So the bus crash in Rio, there's no kind of context for that. And as we see this context declining, we're losing our ability to discern between what is valuable information and what is valueless information. Are we seeing that in our students?
Yes.
Maybe?
Yes.
See, knowing, actual knowing, rather than just simply having information, is being trivialised or demoted. What do I mean by demoted? Well, if you can think that, of a continuum going from data, we can collect data on something and build up a sense of information on a particular topic, and then that can lead us to a knowing, a knowledge of something. And we know as Christians that ultimately, when we see the world through God's glasses, biblical glasses, we can come to a point of wisdom as well. But what are technologies that we are weaving into the very fabric of our everyday lives are doing? Well, these technologies are just really, really good at data and information. And the more we weave these into the fabric of our lives, the less we are actually taking ourselves all the way along to the point of knowledge and wisdom. T.S. Eliot said this in a poem back in 1934. Where is the wisdom that we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? 1934. How much more so now, perhaps, could those questions be asked? How does this picture make you feel?
Yes. Oh, my God. Oh. Good.
If we had time, I'd say discuss that with your table, but we'll move on. There's a lot we could say there. And this statistic floats around the internet a little bit. I don't know if it's true. Can't prove it, but it probably is. A person now is subject to more information in a day than a person in the Middle Ages had access to in their entire life. If you just think about the advertisements, commercials that one gets exposed to in a day, that probably is true, yeah? Now, Tim Keller, one of my favourite Bible teachers, says this: idolatry is when we take a good thing and we make it an ultimate thing. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We're taking the good thing of information and we're making it an ultimate thing.
Yeah.
Anyone read The Shallows by Michael Carr? Yeah, I'd highly recommend this book to you. A brilliant analysis of how we are shallowing in our, well, lots of aspects because of the way we're integrating technologies. He says this: with writing on the screen, we're still able to decode text quickly. We read, if anything, faster than ever. Right? Our reading rates have not slowed down. But we are no longer guided toward a deep, personally constructed understanding of the text's connotations. Instead, we're hurried off toward another bit of related information, and then another, and then another. This is writing, reading on the screen, yeah? And he calls it, the strip mining of relevant content replaces the slow excavation of meaning. Yeah, now, isn't it wonderful that we have all these technologies and we have a plethora of information that we can bounce around? And it's great. But is it coming at a cost? Is there a compromising happening with our reading? It's a question worth asking. All right. Quickly, at the table, just come up with two or three things that you could state and say about informationism. Two things you've just learnt. Go for it. 30 seconds. Oh, thank you. That was really quick. Appreciate that. Digital epistemology. This is, I introduced this before, is the notion that these technologies are changing the way we view where we can find truth and how truth is formed. Just a few ideas I'd like to explore here with this one. Postman again, in his book Technopoly, the weight assigned to any form of truth-telling is a function of the influence of media, of the media of communication. As a culture moves from orality to writing to printing to televising, and I've added in to the internet, its ideas of truth move with it as well. The medium in which you are hearing information will actually determine how much authority you place on that. I mean, we can think of lots of, just even think of how your hairdresser tells you something as opposed to you seeing it on an ABC documentary. Or you understand the notion that the medium will shape how you view your authority. And this is absolutely true when it comes to the internet. I'm going to suggest that what we are seeing, and I don't have time to explore all these, unfortunately, but we are seeing this sense of virtual knowing, a knowing that is in a sense shaped by the virtual nature of the technology that we are getting that information from. A mediated knowing, a knowing which is out of touch, it's removed, it's mediated by the technology. And we're seeing this self-seeking knowing as well. By its very architecture, by its very design, the internet is very self-serving and self-seeking. And so that actually changes and modifies our view of where we gain authority from as well. And this is probably the most significant one for you as librarians to be thinking about. Our technologies are shaping us to see that truth comes by consensus. The majority of people agree on something, then that must be true.
Yeah.
So if you think of Wikipedia, for instance, come to that in a second. If you think of Wikipedia, by its very design, and I'm not saying that Wikipedia is wrong, and I'm not saying you ought not to be promoting Wikipedia with your students or anything. I think it's a great tool. What I'm suggesting is we need to be teaching discernment, which I'll come to at the end. But Wikipedia, by its nature, is this iterative process with a community of users that comes down to what they all agree on to be true, and then that is true. Even when your students are doing Google searches, for instance, you know that they will place a higher level of emphasis on what's at the top ranks. Do they even know there's a second page of results? Exactly. There's not only is that a very underwhelming way of viewing authority, but the algorithms that get your search at the top are all very commercial.
Very complicated, actually, and are very Google serving and not actually truth serving necessarily. I wanted to quickly show you this.
We can come to a point of understanding and knowing something from a number of different sources that help us to come to that place, which for us as Christians, we ultimately want to emphasise revelation there as truth. But through God's common grace, we know that, well, cultural artefacts can help us to come to knowing, and so can experience, and so can reason. Reason and evidence is a good gift.
But I'm going to suggest that the cultural element, the cultural kind of strand, is being increasingly influenced by technology. So technology is taking on much more of a dominant role within that cultural strand. That's just an observation to give you. And we've talked about Wikipedia and Google. Again, sorry, I'm just scratching the surface on that one. This is one I'd really like to talk about. Technology is starting to become increasingly something that we use to mediate between us and aspects of life and the world. Now I'm going to call this technological mediation. In the same way that, can you imagine before there were maps, before cartography, the technology of cartography was around, people had so much more of an intimate understanding of the world around them and location and so forth. You think of our Indigenous folk in Australia. You know, we would find ourselves in the middle of Sydney and go, I'm so not lost. I've got so many different things that I can navigate with. But you take an Indigenous person from Northern Territory and place them in the middle of the CBD of Sydney and they will feel absolutely lost and anxious, just like we would be if we were put in the middle of Arnhem Land and left. Cartography is a technology that actually began a mediation and a distancing from us, of us, between an intimate knowledge and understanding of our world around us. Again, not necessarily a bad thing, a helpful thing. In all of these discussions, I say them under the premise that God has given us this beautiful, wonderful, amazing world, and lots of blessings are part of that world, including our ability to invent and to innovate. I'm not saying for a minute that technology is bad. Hopefully that will come more clear in my conclusion. But if we think of how the map is a mediating technology, well then if we wind that forward to some of our social media, can we see that how social media plays that same role? It mediates between us and authenticity in relationships. It's going between, like a mediator goes between. Have you ever used a text, perhaps, when you really should have made a phone call? Yeah? Well, and our young people now, you notice, they actually don't make phone calls. They all carry phones, but don't make phone calls. Text messages. Why? Why did you make that text message and not the phone call? Or dare I say, the face-to-face communication? Sometimes it's actually easier to have a technology mediate between, for example. Now, Powers says this. He's reflecting upon how his family used to meet after dinner around the television in the lounge room. He said now his teenagers are dispersed into their own rooms and so forth. He's reflecting on that and he says, why not flee the few of the living room for the many of the screen, where all relationships are flattened into one user-friendly mosaic, a human collage that's endlessly clickable and never demands our full attention. Isn't that right? A shallowing of relating such that it's never endlessly clickable but never demands our full attention. If you were to do a Google search for disconnect to connect, there's a lot of people talking about this. There's two books at the moment you can find on Book Depository with the title Disconnect to Connect. Anyway, I found this particular commercial. I'd like to show it to you now. I'm hoping my sound's going to work fine.
Hey guys, time for dinner.
Thank you.
of those on sale outside. Now, I know that's kind of having a bit of fun, but I think that's tapping into something. Yes, there's issues of a kind of addiction there to our technologies, but there's also something about engagement, isn't there, about authentic relational engagement that is not mediated with technology. I'm switching everything over to the internet, my phone, my bills, my TV, my human contact. Here's just some observations. As we move from unmediated intimacy, authentic, relational, embodied intimacy, as we move along towards mediated living, as we more and more weave these technologies into our lives, I'm going to suggest that we're seeing some things happening. I think we're seeing an increasing dependency on technology. And not just in general, but specifically in regards to relationships. Almost an increasing dependency on some form of mediation in my relationships. I'm losing the ability to be able to do it properly, authentically. I need that technology. Some of you may have had the experience of saying, you know, to a year nine class, we're going on a school camp and we're going for a week. And not only can you not bring your mobile phones, your tablets, your iPads or iPods and iWhatevers, there's no reception there. Can you see you'll see the panic in their face. And the psychologists do talk about this as a recognised thing, that there is a techno absence anxiety that we're seeing. I mean, that's why they sleep with their phones, because they can't be disconnected for any length of time. They can't miss something, miss any information, or miss some form of connection. I think we're seeing also a relational laziness. The more we mediate with our technologies, the more we are kind of relationally lazy. It's a little easier to make that text than to have the phone call, for example. I think we're seeing an increasing emphasis on our mediated self-identity. Wow. Now, if we think about how much time our young people spend massaging and nurturing their online personas, their online identities, sometimes it's even more than their real walking around identities. We're seeing increasing emphasis on our mediated self-identity. And I just think we're seeing these distancing effects happening in all of these ways. Tim Chalice says this: many of us are more concerned with who we are in a mediated context than who we are before those who live in the same neighbourhood or who attend the same church. If you've ever, you know, gone to the Facebook page, for instance, of some of your female students, you know, if you're in a school context that allows that to happen, you'll notice that they just look completely different. Completely. The persona they present there is a very, very different one. I like this phrase. Gruthius is saying that, our voice is extending in the biggest sense of the word voice, but the person is receding. The voice extends, but the person recedes. Such that if I was to sum up a kind of a worldview summary for a digital native, it might go like this. Sorry if that's a bit small at the back, I'll read it out. A digital native might sort of think about what a human is, who they are, by saying, I'm a highly connected individual who is free to construct my own identity via digital representations of myself. Where am I? What's the nature of the world that I'm living in as a digital native? Well, I'm living in a world that's with infinite technological possibilities. You'd have to forgive them for seeing it that way. A world of mass information and unlimited connectivity. What's not right about the world? What unsettles me? What makes me anxious in this world? Well, people place expectations and relational demands on me that I do not wish to be bothered with. You can see some other worldview storylines impacting there of individualism and so on.
my rights over the rights of the community. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Solution in the mind of a digital native might be this. It's easy. I will use some form of technology to mediate between me and the aspects of reality that place unwanted expectations on me. I will choose, via my devices, what information I will engage with and what people I will relate to and when, that whole kind of asynchronous nature of communicating with technology. And I will use technology to create and to recreate my identity, my identities, constantly.
Selfie sticks help you capture perfectly composed pictures without your forearm in the shot. But you always feel self-conscious using one. Well, there's a way to get the perfect picture without looking like a narcissistic loner. It's called a friend. Take pictures confidently and comfortably, knowing that you don't look like the world's saddest wizard. In fact, you look more socially adjusted than ever before. Many concert venues and museums have banned selfie sticks, but a friend can always get through the door. And a friend is the only selfie stick that can hold a conversation about your experiences. Why, you may even find with a friend you're more interested in enjoying your surroundings instead of documenting them for strangers on the internet. But that's not all. Friend is the only selfie stick with the ability to automatically adjust framing, focus, and picture quality in an instant. Other selfie sticks can only expand up to a few feet, but Friend can extend as far as you want it to. 1 foot, 5, 800. Friend can do it in a snap, and also do things like drive you to the airport or tell you when you're taking too many pictures.
Yeah. Yeah, the friend. I've got them on sale outside as well. This one's a fairly obvious one in many ways, I think. What I'll first start saying with this one is that, are we actually seeing a change in our view of what virtuous character is? Previously, we've all battled with a sense of narcissism in one form or another since the fall, right? That's part of our brokenness, I believe. But you know what? We have actually got all these technologies in place now, completely architectured around a narcissistic framework, such that we are seeing narcissism become a virtue. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
And as we think about, just this one little snapshot here, if you go to YouTube and kind of look at how many young people who simply talk to camera at regular intervals and post those on their channel, and you can follow these vlogs and so forth. And the YouTube is absolutely full of that notion. And that's not bad in itself, but it's creating a highly kind of self-focused approach. Now, there was this research done, a longitudinal study in San Diego University. So from 1982 to 2006, and they surveyed 16,000 students over that time. So a decent study. And they measured what's known as the narcissistic personality inventory. It's a standard psychological test that's been around for many years. The results, just very quickly, they had found in that time period, 1982 to 2006, a 30% increase in the NPI. And the report says this: gadgets and online social networking sites have stoked the self-loving tendencies of modern students. Yes, the tendency has always been there, but these devices and these technologies, well, they're stoking it. They're giving fuel to the fire, if you like. What was her name again? Jean Twenge, or however you pronounce her name. She says in her book, The Narcissism Epidemic, she cites four main things that are attributing to this narcissism epidemic that she's identifying in American culture. She says permissive parenting. Gosh, we could spend a conference on that one too, couldn't we? A celebrity-obsessed culture. Easy access to credit is a very interesting one. Maybe that's more of appropriate to North American context, but I think that you could argue there's influences of that here too. But mostly, I'd like to highlight the fact that she says that our digital technologies, our social networking, is one of the main fuels for this narcissism epidemic. She says this: social networking sites reinforce narcissism in an endless loop. Narcissists, I think that's supposed to be plural, narcissists have more friends on these sites, and narcissistic behaviour and images are rewarded. See how it's a positive feedback loop? The users are more likely to be connected with people who are more narcissistic than the average person. So in addition to the site structure facilitating narcissistic promotion, the way users are connected may pull the norm of behaviour towards narcissism as well. And then that's being observed by others, and then so that gets pulled more and more. Interesting sort of sociological sort of analysis there. Found this t-shirt the other day. I'll zoom in on it for you. Venn diagram. If you combine narcissism and stalking, you get Facebook. Narcissism and ADHD, you get MySpace. Combine them all together and you've got Twitter. Look, I wouldn't take too much on that, but it's fun.
Are you a Christian girl that loves taking photos of her devotions? You spend hours framing the perfect picture without the payoff of people noticing how spiritual you are on the internet? Introducing Christian Girl Instagram, 101 tips and tricks to get more likes on your devotional photos. Hi, I'm John Crist with Christian Girl Instagram. Do you struggle to get likes on those devotional Instagram photos? Hashtag the struggle is real. From the best-selling author of Shameless Workout Selfies comes Christian Girl Instagram.
I always get so stressed out trying to decide which Bible verse to show. Not anymore.
Okay, you're always going to want to stay away from common verses like Jeremiah 29:11 or John 3:16. No matter what verse you choose, you always want to make sure you highlight multiple verses with multiple colors. Because after all, what's the point of having devotions if no one knows about it?
I used to spend 5 minutes reading the Bible, and then like 30 minutes trying to figure out a hashtag. And then I found Christian Girl Instagram.
My book includes over 1,000 hashtag suggestions like Coffee with Colossians, Bliss, Serenity, Much Needed, and of course, hashtag Blessed.
As it goes on. We've got those on the bookstall. That's good. This is a Christian philosopher. I'd like to just quote some of his, read some of the quotes from him. He talks about what we're talking about now as the device paradigm, a way of seeing. And let me just share with you some of these quotes, they're gold. He says, with the device paradigm, we're seeing an increasing disengagement from life as fabrics of intimacy are being lost. There is a move out of reality and into the bluff and illusion of virtual reality. I wonder whether we're seeing... There's always bullying, and bullying, I guess, will always be. But didn't we see a kind of spike in bullying with the possibilities of cyberbullying? Yeah. Because we're seeing... what does he say? There's a move out of reality into the bluff and illusion... the fabrics of intimacy are being lost. It's very different to say to someone into their face, you know, you're ordinary. But to do it online is much easier, isn't it? We're seeing the replacement of wonder with dazzle and of communication with decontextualized information. That's that informationism we spoke of. Sorry if I'm going too fast. Do you want it? There you go. You got it? All right. This is actually the one I wanted to highlight in terms of cyberbullying. We're seeing the loss of civility as people are removed from the thick world of context. I love that phrase. The thick world of context. we're seeing the decline in the ability of people to remember, imagine, and persevere in thought. I mean, from an educationalist point of view, we could do lots of exploring and thinking about this and the research that's going on. But anecdotally, are you seeing this with your students? We're seeing an increasing commitment to technological leisure and entertainment. Your kids at recess and lunch, you know, they simply want, they need almost technology for entertainment. And an increasing boredom, actually. And I've added an increasing sense of hopelessness and despair and depression because of these things aren't actually delivering what they are subconsciously promising our young people. Well, what about Christian education then? And we're coming to where we can see the finish line on the track now, and we're heading down the straight, so just to pace yourselves. I'm going to suggest that in society, I want to suggest three postures, three ways in which we are viewing technology in our society, and I think within education as well. One is this notion of instrumentalism or technological instrumentalism. And this is the notion where we have the view that technology is kind of over here and it's kind of neutral and it really just depends on how we use it. Technology is not a problem. We've just got to make sure we're godly in how we use it. It's not really having an effect on us. We can choose how we use it. It's just an instrument at our disposal. And the other two are a form of determinism, which says that, well, actually, technology, by its very existence, actually does shape us. It actually has a determining effect on how we understand the world and how we live our lives. And I want to talk about a naive technological determinism and a discerning technological determinism. Now, discerning, that's where I'm ultimately wanting to head in this talk today. To be sharing with us that I believe that we, as Christian educators, Christian librarians, can actually take a discerning approach to technology and teach our students, disciple our students to have a discerning approach to technology. Okay, first of all, technological instrumentalism. Carr says this in The Shallows. He says, instrumentalism is the most widely held view of technology, not least because it is the view we would prefer to be true. The idea that we are somehow controlled by our tools is anathema to most people. And then Marshall McLuhan, I just love this quote here. He doesn't pull any punches. Our conventional response to all media, namely that it is how they are used that counts, is the numb stance of the technological idiot. For the content of a medium is just the juicy piece of meat carried by the burglar to distract the watchdog of the mind. Speaking of words this morning and how words can be beautiful, I think there's a beauty in that expression there. That notion that it's not just the content that's trapped that carries, but the actual medium itself will have a shaping influence. Just like our technology, our digital technologies, our social networking technologies will. Marshall McLuhan is actually famous for, have I got it? This quote here. The medium is the message. But I'd like to share this one too, though, by Colgan. We become what we behold. We shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us. This is this notion of determinism that I hope that we've well explored today with the things that I've opened up. He goes on to say, the effects of technology do not occur at the level of opinions or concepts. Rather, they alter the patterns of perception and without any resistance. So, if we think about the effect that the clock had, for instance, technology of the clock. But previous to the clock timekeeping
was a very imprecise thing, and it really didn't, punctuality, times, structural, you know, breaking the days up into units and so on, it didn't have a big influence greatly
in people's lives. But let me just read this quote from Carr. He says, under the sway of the mechanical clock, people began thinking of their brains and their bodies, of the entire universe in fact, as operating like clockwork. You see that not only did it change the structure of society, but it actually changed the way we started to perceive the world as well. We found in the clock's tightly interconnected gears, we found a mechanistic metaphor that seemed to explain the working of all things, as well as relations between them. God became the great clockmaker, for instance. His creation was no longer a mystery to be accepted, it was a puzzle to be worked out. Now, right or wrong there aside, can you see how the existence of excellent timekeeping pieces actually framed our worldview? And as we've already spoken of, the map and the way the map changed that as well. And how much did the printing press, Gutenberg's machine, change the whole fabric of society? Yes, but our whole way of understanding, our epistemology changed. Our worldview changed in so many ways with that invention. Again, Postman in his book Technopoly says this, a new technology does not add or subtract something. It changes everything. In the year 1500, 50 years after the printing press was invented, we did not have an old Europe plus the printing press. We had a different Europe. After television, the United States was not America plus television. Television gave a new coloration to every political campaign, to every home, to every school, to every church, to every industry, and how much more so the internet. All right. Just stick with me with this. This is me just having a bit of a play around, and I'm going to sort of be a little indulgent and bring you with my little play around, bring you into it. If we can start with naive technological determinism. Technology, they keep inventing new things, and they have effect on us. Yep, nothing we can do about that, that's just happening. Right, so that's a naive determinism. Yes, there's technologies, we don't really have much control or say about that, but it's changing us, oh well. But if we look at that, if we sort of now explore a biblical worldview, excuse me, that says that we as humans, God has given us, well, human agency, he's given us the ability to think, the ability to take the stuff of this world that he has given us and to cultivate that good stuff, including inventing and innovating, including technologies and so forth. So then, well, from that point we can say, well, we have abilities, we have a responsibility as Christians, as people now, to use these technologies wisely. One path we can take is to say that, well, technology is neutral, we've just got to make sure we use it well. That's that instrumentalism. But the other path recognises that the technology is not neutral. Technologies have got, they have got worldviews of the inventor woven into them. They've got the commercial frameworks of those who are innovating them woven into them. They are not neutral. They have a shaping influence, as we've been exploring. So we can then talk about a discerning technological determinism. It would be easy, would it not? It would be just sort of simple as for Christians to navigate through life if we could just understand the world to be broken up into good things and bad things. With the world, there's the kingdom of God, there's the sacred things, and then there's the world or the secular things. That'd be easy. It's not that way. This is a very dualistic thinking that we get from the early Western thinkers, the Greeks, Plato and his pals. The world isn't like that. God has actually says that the world is good. All of it is good. What did he say after every day? It is good. It is good. And at the very end, it is very good. The whole world is good. Yet, the whole world has been damaged, broken, distorted, has the effects of the fall. So really what we're looking at is this, that every part of the world, every part of life, every part of God's good creation has got a crack in it, if you like. So, and then in Scripture we see this notion of there being a kind of battle going on between the kingdom of light and the kingdom of darkness, and that is kind of a constant battle that goes on even within the church, even within theology, prayer, that everything has been tainted by the fall, though everything is good. Including technology, which is why I'm making this point. So, summary. The very essence of the creation is that God made it good. And it includes all the cultural strands like technology, like language and words, like politics, like family. It is good. Yet, there is a tendency from every aspect of technology to be either drawing us towards God or away from God. There is a tendency on every part of creation to be drawing us towards shalom, God's design for good human flourishing, or away from shalom, God's good design for human flourishing, peace. And we see that with our technologies as well, social networking, for instance. We see a tendency there for it to be either drawing us away from shalom or to shalom. And we need to recognize that. No, I'm not talking about Twitter. I literally want you to follow me. All right, I'm going to be summing up now. And a conclusion. My conclusion is this. I hope you've been hearing me say this, that on one hand, we should be embracing the good creational essence of technology. And you guys have this wonderful opportunity of being at the kind of coalface for many of those technologies in the lives of young people. Embrace the good creational essence of that. There's some wonder and some really helpful things to find. And we do that knowing that Christ has and is redeeming all things. But on the other hand, I hope you've been hearing me say this, that we need to be discerning the shaping effects of those technologies. We need to be teaching our students, dare I even suggest discipling our students in our schools, to be discerning those shaping effects, those distorting effects as well. And we need to help those in our care to read when and how they are being shaped. That's not easy. I don't for a minute suggest that this is easy, because our digital natives are, well, we're not just talking about habits here. We're not just talking about lifestyle. We're talking about their very worldview has been shaped by these technologies. So we're talking about changing the way they completely see the world from the ground up or from the inside out, whatever metaphor. And that's not an easy task. And it's my prayer for you guys as librarians in the roles that you have, that you will be able to celebrate with them the wonder and the beauty and with curiosity, these great tools that God has blessed us with, but be also able to chip away at their worldview in different places to see that there is this richer life of shalom that God has for them.